A different future starts with you. That's why GoDaddy does more than help you find a name. You can create, sell, and get found online so any small business can make a change. We need a new generation of thinking, your way of thinking. Start different at GoDaddy.com.
COVID-19 patients need your help.
If you've fully recovered from COVID-19
or unknowingly been exposed to it,
you may have the antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients recover.
Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies.
Visit Vitalant.org today to schedule an appointment to donate blood.
That's Vitalant.org. Help save lives and schedule your appointment at Vitalant.org.
You could help save lives.
This is an ode to Napa cabbage. Of all the cabbages on all the cabbage farms, only you have the crisp crunch worthy of our Bibigo Korean dumplings. No other cabbage would do, because no other cabbage tastes like you. We love you, Napa cabbage. Just don't tell Green Onion. Napa cabbage, one of many obsessively crafted ingredients in every hearty, flavorful Korean dumpling from Bibigo. Go handcrafted. Go Bibigo. Authentic Korean dumplings now in the freezer aisle.
This is Podco Media Networks.
It's the Innovation Podcast with Mark Reed Edwards and Garnett Harriman. Let's start the show.
We've got another great guest with us today, Deshaun Drew, Community Network Vice President at the Bush Foundation. I've looked at his background and the work he's doing now, and I'm really eager to hear the discussion, so I'll hand it over to you, Garnett.
Thanks. Deshaun, I think it's worth maybe a 30-second backstory. Deshaun and I have known each other since grade school, high school. I can't remember exactly what.
Before either of us had gray hair.
And lots of obligations and liabilities, right? We grew up in a suburb of New York on Long Island. We went to public school. And then him, much more so than me, went on to a very distinguished career in both academics. I'll let Deshaun talk about his own background when he gets a chance. From there, on to journalism, and ended up in very senior roles in at least one major newspaper in the Midwest that I know of, and there could be others. And I'm leaving room for you to fill in the gaps. Then took a very interesting turn towards the nonprofit foundation and maybe more importantly, the impact world, both investing and programmatic aspects of impact. And so he brings to the table a lot of understanding about how media affects folks and organizations and cultures. He brings to the table a lot of understanding about how to apply money and other forms of capital, program, relationship capital, network capital, to really sticky problems that a lot of people don't want to talk about, but we as a society need to make progress on. And I am, like Mark, I'm totally fascinated by the different things that he brings to the table. And I think he's a man suited for the times. I'd love to turn it over a little bit to you, Deshaun, and maybe you want to talk a little bit about your background, and then we'll get into the meat of the matter from there.
Sounds good, Garnett. Thanks again for having me on. So my background, as you said, was primarily in journalism. I toured with the idea of becoming an historian, so I went to grad school in history and realized that I needed to be focused on modern times and with real people a little more and less in the stacks. But it certainly informed, I think, the way I approached my journalism career in terms of being able to bring context to the stories to help my readers understand how we got to now. And my interest in journalism was really driven by both curiosity about people and circumstances, but also a real interest in helping people better understand and hopefully really see and value one another. I spent more than 20 years working primarily at the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, but also a few years at the Dallas Morning News. Did everything from working as a general assignment reporter, covering everything, anything, kind of what was thrown at me from day to day, to a lot of time covering K-12 education issues, both in Dallas and here in Minnesota, to ultimately shifting to editing and managerial roles. My last role at the Star Trip was as the managing editor for operations. So it was a lot of project management. And a lot of my focus was also on recruitment and retention within the newsroom, particularly recruiting and retaining journalists who are people of color, because it was and remains a real challenge within the industry. Made the transition about 4.5 years ago. I was lucky enough to get recruited to the job I'm in now at the Bush Foundation, which is a St. Paul, Minnesota-based foundation You could argue in some respects that we're a product of 3M, Minnesota Mining Manufacturing. Our founder, Archibald Mush, and his wife, Edith Bush. Archie made his money as a senior leader at 3M back in the day, and he and his wife were always very civically engaged. They gave time and money to make this community, this region stronger, and they set up our foundation in 1953. And the only real direction we were given and that we still operate by was to do as much possible good as we could with the resources. Over time, what that's come to me in terms of our primary areas of focus is that we pour a lot of time and energy, money into leadership development, pour those same things into community-driven problem solving.
Very cool. Thank you for that background. I've spent some time since you and I have been talking about different projects that we want to collaborate on, looking at the Bush Foundation, and I'm sort of fascinated by the founder and the namesake, Archibald.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's worth maybe giving a soundbite or two about his background and his vision. I didn't know until fairly recently that he started his career at 3M as an accountant. That's somewhat surprising to me, and then rose up through the ranks. You know, typically you don't see guys in publicly traded companies who are chairman of the executive committee who are accountants necessarily. It's an interesting perspective. I'll say for the record, and I'm not trying to complain or anything, but I think Mark is paying me the exact same salary that Archibald was making as an accountant.
So not a lot. Less than minimum wage.
I'm getting exactly $11.55 a week to do this podcast, so time for a raise.
That much?
Yeah, so Archie was fascinating. He grew up on a farm in western Minnesota, a few hours west of the Twin Cities, west of Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Is that Granite Falls?
In Granite Falls, exactly. It's Granite Falls, Minnesota. And it's a beautiful community. River runs through it. It's really very scenic.
Nice.
And his dream as a child was to grow up and be a farmer like his pop. And he had hay fever, so he couldn't farm. He had to get an education.
Damn.
In some other area, and chose accounting, worked for a precursor for 3M, and he, along with a guy named William McKnight and some others, built the company we know of as 3M. They were visionary and incredibly hardworking, and they took what had been a sandpaper manufacturing company. Let's let that sit with you for a while. That's all they did initially, was make sandpaper. And they not only improved the quality and the reach of the initial products, but over time added a bunch of other products. And Archie was the lead salesperson in time for the company. So he had a bunch of different roles, you mentioned.
Wow.
In the executive committee. But en route to that job, he led sales. And what really distinguished him was that his sales teams would provide kind of shotgun with other salesmen and come in and show people how to use their products. And so even before they had the best product on the market, they had the best service on the market. In time, they had both.
Wow.
And the company grew.
3M is still well known for a lot of those principles. I know a little bit about their ventures group, 3M Ventures Group. It's not even run out of this country anymore. Most of the 3M Ventures guys are in Germany, I think.
Yeah, it's a global powerhouse now.
They do exactly what you just described. The ventures guys ride shotgun on the sales and product guys. It's really, really interesting because they're so committed to like only spending money on things that enhance the customer experience and the customer's customer's experience. Very interesting to see how far back that goes. So today, to put a framework around this, we're going to talk about leadership development, and we're going to talk about, I want to call it incubating and sort of proselytizing ideas, incubating and spreading ideas. Let's jump into leadership development. What aspect of the Bush Foundation's work is focused around that? If you want to get down to like the programmatic level, I think that would be super useful. I remember our first discussion about your work, and some of it didn't start to really gel for me until I got down to your programmatic level. And then when I looked at it holistically, it made perfect sense, like why you guys are having such a huge impact on your region.
So when Archie was alive, these past some years ago, but when he was alive and still in the business world, he just had an eye for talent and also had a real commitment to helping people pursue their dreams. So there were a number of, this is 1930s, 40s, 50s, so young, promising white men, talented guys coming along, and he lent and gave them money so they could further their education. Everything from sending folks off to Harvard Business School to helping one guy get his doctor's license, get his MD. And so he
wow.
just had a real heart for people who were ambitious and talented and wanted to help them achieve their dreams. And so our fellowship program, the Bush Fellowship Program, really is an outgrowth of that. In its current form, we take up to 24 people a year and give them each $100,000 to work on becoming better leaders. And that's a really broad thing because there are a lot of different kinds of leaders out there, a lot of different dreams that people are chasing. And so our focus is around helping people who have already accomplished a fair amount. I don't mean by that like they have to be the CEO of an organization, you know, that level of accomplishment, but they've got a story to tell about what they've done so far with the options that they've been given. And more importantly, they've got a story to tell about what they want to do down the road. They have a picture of themselves down the road a bit and a version of themselves that is more effective, more impactful in the community in some way. And they have a sense of what skills they need to develop, what relationships they need to establish, what experiences they need to get under their belt to become that version of themselves. And the fellowship, the money, and a ton of coaching and networking and other kinds of support poured into them to help them realize those dreams. And not just an investment. It's typically spent over a 2-year span. But the investment isn't just about those 2 years. It's really about the rest of their lives and really about not just them, but the impact that they can have on a broader community. And that community can be geographically framed. People might want to change life here in St. Paul, Minnesota, or it could be about the thematic community. They could be working in the arts, working in education or in healthcare, any number of other arenas, and have a vision for how they can make things in those spaces better.
If you've recovered from COVID-19 or unknowingly been exposed to it, you may have antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients. Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies. Visit Vitalant.org today.
Let's drill down a little bit. How does the fellowship program work? And what are the key inputs and outputs? And how does your system work for recruiting folks into the fellowship program?
So we put a lot of time and energy into just making sure people are aware that fellowship even exists. This is kind of an unusual thing. Typically, when you think about foundations, you think about grants to organizations, right? Not so much grants to individuals. In fact, we have a special letter from the IRS that lets us make these grants to individuals. Not something you can typically do. So we spend a lot of time and energy literally traveling the region. And for us, our region is Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native Nations within that same geography. So think Red Lake, think Standing Rock, think Pine Ridge. We spend a lot of time making sure we're out and about across the region, drumming up awareness of the fellowship. And we typically will get north of 700 applications, as I said already, kind of boil that down over a period of months to the 23 fellows. And we're actively working to try and make lots of different kinds of people feel like their dreams, their goals could fit within the fellowship program. And it's not that anybody can get it, but we don't have a limited definition of what a leader is, and we don't have a limited list of things they ought to be pursuing. We promote it, we get a fair number of applications in, and then we rely on alumni to help us with the first sort and selection to cut the number from 700 down to a more manageable number. And then we go through 2 internal staff rounds where teams will read internally and select what we believe to be the most promising of the applicants in the mix. And then at the end, when we're down to the 36 finalists, we actually rely on community leaders, a mix of alumni of the program and business and community and political leaders to read the applications from the finalists and then literally physically come here and interview them face to face and get a sense, not, you know, why are you good enough to get a fellowship, but tell us a little bit more about your vision. Tell us a little bit more about what brought you to this point. The real purpose, as I said, with the fellowship is to identify what growth they need, what experiences they need, what connections they would need to really be able to play at that next level. And so we rely on community leaders to help us choose, in the end, the folks who get the fellowship opportunity. Once they've been selected, they get a ton of additional coaching and support to help them polish their plans for how they would use the time and the money that we have with them. And they get after it. Some of them pursue formal degrees out of the box or off the shelf, I should say, you know, degrees that institutions around the country are offering. More often than not, though, it's more like going to the grocery store and getting a little of this, a little of that, a little of this. And you know, some of them might go and work on their public speaking and presentation skills as part of their plan. Some might decide they need more finance chops. Some might decide they need a little more time thinking about how to develop strategy. Some might need coaching in particular arenas where there are people who are experts in those spaces that they need to go spend time with. It's a really flexible grant program. It allows people to do what they need to do to round themselves out. It's not cohort-based because we're not all chasing the same dreams, but we do make a point of bringing them together a few times over the period that they're on fellowship. Right. So they have a chance to meet the other fellows. And a big piece of it is we want them to be, while they're on this journey, to be really reflective and to make course corrections as it makes sense to do so. Even though we're not with them physically throughout the 2 years, some of them are here in the Twin Cities. Many of them are living elsewhere in the region or sometimes living across the country if they're in school. But we have them on a monthly basis respond to prompts that are designed to get them really thinking deeply about their journey that they're on, what they're struggling with, what they're learning, and what they ought to be doing to pivot when that's something that starts to come into view. Beyond submitting their own monthly essays, these reflections, they're also responsible, expected to read the prompts or the responses rather from their fellows. It's a great way as they're sort of chasing their dreams to process their own thoughts, but also be holding on some level the challenges and learning that others are encountering along the way.
So vision development, academic training, coaching, business coaching, and otherwise motivation coaching. I'm curious, and I think it's implied in some of the things that you just listed as far as activities and then the typical uses of funds and activities post-grant and that sort of thing. I'm curious how many of these folks, as they're getting more sophisticated about developing their vision and the skill sets and the networks for implementing, start thinking in the direction of their personal brand and trying to either amplify or create a larger platform for their personal brand for getting that vision out and implemented.
You know, a significant number of people do. That's a great question.
Yeah.
Part of having impact is being known.
Sure. You know why I'm thinking about it? I'm thinking about it from the standpoint of emerging media like podcasting.
Uh-huh.
Something that's so inherently egalitarian, right? That has lowered the barriers for lots of distribution technology mm-hmm. about thought leadership. It seems like it's something that could be tailor-made for some of the activities and the goals that come out of the folks who actually win your fellowship. That's what I was asking. So has anyone ever submitted their monthly reflection as a recorded audio file or, God forbid, a podcast? Wouldn't that be hilarious?
We could lend a hand.
For now, it's an application where we have to go in and respond to questions and their character counts. There isn't a video application at the moment. But, you know, we've talked a lot about ways we might, over time, make it a more flexible application process, especially for people who maybe they don't communicate as well in writing as they might do something like a podcast, do some sort of presentation that lets them just kind of speak and present their thoughts.
What's the broad breakdown for the folks who end up winning the Bush Leadership Fellowship? What percentage are in the either social venture / commercial space versus things like either a nonprofit foundation or community development space?
It's a smaller percentage than the nonprofit side, but it's growing. And I think oftentimes those lines are blurring anyway. So many sure. of the nonprofits we see out there, in part because they're looking for ways to make sure they're sustainable, are looking sure. for ways to generate income and to structure things in a way that gives them the financial, not just stability, but the power and the resource to do even more things on the social sector side. So we're seeing a lot of folks who are kind of walking that line. A number of the folks that we work with have often worked in different sectors as well, which I think is another really valuable thing. Folks who worked in, say, corporate and want to move over to a nonprofit kind of role, or folks who work in government and are now heading into maybe the corporate dimensions, have some sort of public service dimension to them. All the grant making we're doing ultimately is about making the region stronger. So no one gets paid just becoming rich themselves, but it's fine to become rich in the process of creating something that the community is really going to benefit from. We see lots of different kinds of people come through, and some of them are thinking more like business people tend to think and structuring their approaches to how they would use the fellowship time than folks maybe running nonprofits. I mean, there's necessarily a huge difference there, but sometimes it's about sort of the lens that comes across in the application. And by design, the program is meant to be for folks in all the different sectors. So we actively promote it to folks who work in government, to folks who work in the private sector, to folks working in the nonprofit sector and education as well.
Other than the sheer sort of ingenuity and cleverness about how the program is constructed, and I guess the big aspect there is just the depth of community involvement. That seems really unique about the program itself. I'm just blown away that you've been doing this for 50 years. Not you personally, but the Bush Foundation. That's incredible.
Yeah. What's beautiful about it is that, not that you could throw a stick and hit a Bush fellow, but if you were to pick up the Star Tribune and the Absolute Paper today and read through it, there's a good chance you'll find a Bush fellow or two figuring in some way into some story, because they're in all aspects of life here, leading roles in life here. And so it's a great network of folks doing really important work. Some of them are better known and more visible roles than others are. But those investments, as I said, they're crossing so many different parts of our community that we've been able, through investing in good people over time, we've been able to impact so many aspects of life here.
Excellent. Now that we've established how far back this goes, now it's getting kind of interesting to me from a network standpoint. You guys are like legion. How many Bush fellows are there in total?
You know, we've minted more than 2,500 of them now. I don't know how many are still standing.
But good Lord.
The vast majority of them are, and the vast majority of them are still doing something meaningful in this region. And even the ones who we've lost to other parts of the country, they're making their patch of grass. It's a lot. And, you know, we're trying to get smarter and better, actually helping them connect more easily to one another, because it's such a powerful network to be a part of. For the people who get it, it really does open doors. You say you're a Bush fellow in this region, that means something to people. And so they're more apt to make time for you and more apt to take you maybe a little more seriously than they might otherwise. Depends on the person, obviously. Some people, just based on their titles, will already be taken more seriously by others. But I think there's a respect that people in the region have.
I want to get back to that network power and potential in a minute, but I'm curious now from the standpoint of like a superlative development or a superlative sort of memory. Of all those stories that you've heard or heard of from Bush Fellows, where they came from, how they won the grant, what they did with the money and the downstream impact, what's one story that sticks out in your head of that sort of arc of development from pre-Bush Fellow to post-Bush Fellow to impactful citizen of the region?
What comes to mind for me is that so many of these folks, when they got the fellowship, there may have been one specific project they were working on. Say they are passionate about healthcare and they wanted to develop stronger skills and a stronger network in that arena. And they did that, they had success, and then they discovered the connection between healthcare and housing. So they found themselves wandering into that arena. And you look up a few years later and wandering into food and diet. And so I think it's been really powerful about this fellowship program is that even though folks come through the door with one thing in mind, if you get a fellowship and you're like 35, 40 years old, you're going to work another 25 to 40 years. And their impact isn't even something they can understand at that stage, what's possible for them. What I've been struck by is the many Bush fellows out there who are working in areas that might seem far afield from what they're originally working on. And over time, their smarts and their passion, their hustle and their leadership skills allowed them to move across multiple areas because they developed the skills and the network to be able to play in those different arenas. And so we've watched folks move from working on housing issues to working on health issues to working on economic development issues. They would tell you that the current version of themselves isn't what they had in mind 30 years ago, but they went where the opportunities arose and they kind of chased new dreams as those popped up. We're not trying to change any one community or any one sector. We're really trying to change the face and shape and sort of approach the leadership in this region. And I should say, a big part of that is about trying to produce leaders who are truly inclusive, who lead in ways that tap into the talents of the people around them, whether those people are above, below, or on the same level as them on a table of organization. We need trying to produce leaders who've got the ability to see the talent around them and harness it.
All right, Dushan, Garnett, and I will be back next time to continue our chat about the Bush Foundation, and we learn about BushCon, short for Bush Connect, a networking event designed to build stronger and more meaningful connections among networks of leaders. Plus, we learn more about what the foundation is doing around innovation and lots more.
Thanks for joining Garnett and Mark on the Innovation Podcast. Visit theinnovationpodcast.co to subscribe and listen to other episodes.